Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Tonight, we're going to focus on digital health technologies and their impact on healthcare access and patient outcomes. In this hour, we'll hear from Ram Fish, founder and CEO of 19 Labs, Adam Pellegrini, vice president of digital health at Walgreens, and Einar Sawyer of the Center for Digital Health Innovations at UC San Francisco. This conversation is moderated by Adam Satriano, technology reporter at Bloomberg News. The program was recorded live in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator.
So now it's my pleasure to introduce our panelists. To my left, your right, I have Einar Sawyer, who's Associate Director of Strategic Relations for the UCSF Center for Digital Health and Innovation and Assistant Clinical Professor in the UCSF Department of Orthopedic Surgery. To her left is Adam Pellegrini, is the Vice President of Digital Health at Walgreens, which has an interesting role to play in this space. And to his left is Ram Fish, who's a co-founder and CEO of 19 Labs, which is a startup in the digital health space. And prior to starting that company, he was a Vice President for Digital Health at Samsung. So we have a great panel. And during this, we're going to be trying to explore digital health and what all of this technological innovation means for the current status and future of health systems around the world, whether it's remote sensing devices, wearable devices, Apple Watches, Google Watches, Fitbits, telemedicine products. A lot of this is changing how doctors and patients interact. Key to our discussion with these experts will be to identify ways in which digital health is translating into better healthcare and outcomes, and how can consumers and patients take advantage of it, and where it's going to take us over the next 5 to 10 years. And so to start, I'd love to, digital health has been in the news quite a bit. You have big companies like Google and Apple tackling this issue. You also have companies like Fitbit. So it's become somewhat of a sexy topic. A ton of venture capital is going into the area. But I would love to get some perspective, start with you, Adam, some perspective about where we are in the sort of hype versus reality spectrum, and whether or not where our expectations getting a bit out of whack with reality, and where is some of the promise that you are seeing?
Yeah, that's a fantastic, and thank you. This is so far been an amazing conference, and all the panels incredibly informative. Far smarter folks than myself sitting on most of them, so I'm very honored to be here. I would say we deal oftentimes in the digital health area with looking at what's coming next, what's happening now, and what actually is moving the needle. Now, clearly for us, things like our mobile app, which is the third most downloaded retail app and the number one most downloaded brick and mortar app in the country, we see massive amounts of adoption, but it's oftentimes the simplest thing that we see the most adoption. So when we see what's going on, all the newest apps, I heard a quote that there's over 600,000 now mHealth apps in the App Store. You know, when we look at simplicity, we look at, you know, the refill by scan, for example, is a technology where you take a picture of your medicine bottle, and then it gets picked up and refilled in our stores. That is a simple technology. There's nothing incredibly fancy about it, but its simplicity is what made it successful. And we do 1.6 scans every second in that app of the day, every day of the week, every week of the year. So when we look at emerging technologies, it does take quite a bit of work to curate what partners digitally we're going to work with. For example, in telemedicine, we know that it may not necessarily be a now thing, but we see that the trend is going towards that area. So it's worth looking at pilots in that. So I think we see a lot of things out there. There's a lot of noise. But if the things meet convenience, if it saves someone money, saves someone time, and it takes the friction out of care, we kind of look at those as barometers and going in the right direction.
Einar, I'd love to get your thoughts. I know this is something that you spent a great deal of time thinking about, this sort of matching hype with reality.
Yes. I try to do that in my own life, too. So what I usually really try to drill down on is how we need to get from the promise to the power of digital health, or what I call the empower of digital health, when you think of the individual and the capabilities we can provide. I feel like there is tremendous excitement. If you look at investment alone, 2014 was a breakout year, and statistics out of Rock Health and Startup Health, who track these things, $4 billion last year, and we're on track this year to at least have $6 billion in investments. It's one metric, and the other metrics that we really care about are the effectiveness in care and cost. So that's one of the things I think we need to do to get from the promise to the power, is have more evaluation and demonstrate effectiveness in care and cost of the types of technologies that are being pushed out there. And not just technologies, we think of innovation in terms of people, process, and technology. So making sure that the workflow, new roles are being created that need to be created, or new roles for people who are in the workforce but maybe shifting, like the pharmacists, for instance, and the clinical pharmacy assistants are taking on new roles. So I think it's important that we do more effectiveness. That's one. The next is we certainly need more interoperability. We have a lot of some very sterling but siloed solutions being put out there. And if we don't move more towards integrated solutions, we're not going to leverage the benefits of the data that's being generated and even learn from new associations that we haven't been able to do before. So we work very hard in interoperability at the university, and we have an announcement coming out next week about that, a very, very large initiative that hopefully will allow us to have more end-to-end data journeys. Because as you experience your own health, your own health experience, there's a health sphere that I've described, and no matter what the point of contact is for you in your health sphere, you're going to generate data, whether it's at the lab, even at the fitness center, whether it's your private doctor or your health, your home health agency. So you're generating data at all these points of contact. Your body moves freely to the next point of care, but your data doesn't move. And the onus is largely on the patient to make sure all the information is provided to the next point of contact. And it's a really big burden. If that doesn't happen, the consequences are delays or errors in treatment. And so I think it's really important that we do a much better job of moving the data as freely as we move ourselves across all these different points of contact. So that's what we're working on, so we can contextualize the data and make it actionable. And the other two points have to do with really knowing your audience. That's another point we talk about, is if you really want engagement and sustained engagement, and ultimately to incentivize healthy choices, you need to incorporate design thinking, lean launchpad stakeholder interviews, really right up front, and the behavioral sciences. They're going to be the heroes in this movement of empowering people to make healthy choices. And then the last is partnering. I feel like we very much need to link arms across sectors to accelerate the transformations that we can do.
Rama, why don't you jump in here? Where are some of the you see in the most early effectiveness in digital health? What is showing the most promise in terms of technology being used so people have a more informed decisions about their health?
I don't, which is kind of sad, but mostly I'm seeing right now lots of very, very interesting technologies and very little real value for mass market. Sometimes there's value for small niche market and small verticals, but I mostly don't see much of compelling use cases and compelling experiences that apply for mass market, and I think both Adam and Einor pointed some of the problems here. And it reminds me, I spent a lot of time working on the mobile phone industries in the early 90s, and we came up with the first phone in the world that had internet capabilities in it. And that was in 95. It took it more than 10 years till the iPhone was created and mobile phones with internet really took off. The mistake that was made at the time was really focusing on technology and really thinking through the technologies, not realizing things like technology, a development curve, the user factor, how people use it. And there was a very famous slide I used a lot that says, it's never about the technology, it's always about the people. And picking on Adam's word, you used the word simplicity, and that's the key thing I think that's missing right now. We have too many complicated technologies that have huge potential when they catch on and we connect the dots and interoperate it and do the right partnerships. But if we look at the analogy from the mobile industry, the thing that really took off in the beginning was ringtones and texting were the killer applications in the early 2000s. So what we are looking to in some respect right now is the ringtones and the texting of digital health. And I have not seen those yet.
Yeah, and I would just add on to that. So great, great response. I do go back to simplicity. As I mentioned, things like the refill by scan, for example, the one that I mentioned, because of notification and reminders, and this is actually an interesting test. How many people have an iPhone or some type of Android phone in the audience? Raise your hand. Okay. Had to do it. Come on, we got to get lively. Okay. So how many use it to keep track of their calendar, their meetings, right? Okay. Have you noticed meeting adherence gone up since moving from paper to digital? So that's the same concept. Meeting adherence is it's not really a real term. I just made that up. But but think about it. It's the same thing as medication adherence. But it's a simple thing, right? We now take it for granted that we have our calendar on our phone. In the past, we did this, and then we scratched, and then we're like, oh, let's rip this out, throw it over here. We've seen the same adherence lift by using the technology around notification, reminders, SMS, in the Walgreens mobile app. So we've seen a 2.5% PDC lift, which basically means proportion of days covered of a medication has gone up simply because we give people notification reminders that are part of that refill by scan process. Now, that's a very simple process. That's not a sophisticated technology, as I said, but we move a needle 2.5%, which is a significant amount when you do as many prescriptions as we do. So the question is, I think, you know, there are technologies that are actually showing outcomes at scale. Not all of these are going to show outcomes at scale. And I think it is picking out the ones that meet very specific use cases. This is where I think you were going. Stories that are simple in nature that remove friction from an experience and enhance the convenience and access for the consumer. I don't know if that... If you agree.
Yeah, I absolutely do. I think most people want their problem solved. They don't just want a new technology. So if their problems are solved by whatever tool you give them, they're certainly going to engage with it more and longer.
Well, what are some of the problems that you think do need to be solved in that where that this digital, the technology can play a role in solving that problem?
Well, I think one I addressed earlier is it's hard to be a patient. It's really hard. It's hard to understand what information is given to you. Thank goodness we do have many more online resources now, so patients are more informed when they come in. But it's also hard to make sure that your data moves from place to place, as we said before. And it's also hard, I think, at times to have help with your decisions. So decision support, not just for providers, but for patients, is another real opportunity. And the other is, does it fit into your, what I now call, like we say, workflow? I call it life flow. Does it fit into your life flow, or are people trying to get you to make significant changes in the way you would naturally behave? So I think some of the issues that we see that we're targeting are, of course, patient education, patient engagement, patient activation, because we do see outcomes from those that are very promising in terms of readmission rates, in terms of stabilizing chronic diseases. So I'm a little bit more optimistic about evaluation than Ram is, but absolutely we need more of it, and we're getting better at it. And the beauty of digital is that there's a lot of data there if we get the analytics going and we get the information connected. There are great efforts by Walgreens to evaluate their implementations. Same thing with Kaiser, healthcare delivery, academic centers. There are now even private digital health evaluation systems coming up. the methodology is a little different. The methodology needs to move faster. You need to be able to study something that's actually changing in the process of the study as the software reiterates. So there are challenges with it, but I think there's a lot more focus on it. And I have started seeing some good outcomes. Mayo has a nice study about cardiac rehab post-MI. Those who had a program of cardiac rehab versus those who had a program of cardiac rehab but were supported with a digital platform, reinforcing, reminding, et cetera, and they had much fewer readmission rates. So over and over, we're starting to see studies like that. What we need to see, though, is sustained benefits. So the blood pressure studies we saw coming out of Kaiser's study with mobile support, nice results, need to make sure it's sustained because we see a huge drop-off rate at 6 months with the wearables and the consumer-facing apps.
Yeah. I'm so glad you said that. So to that specific point, here is an interesting problem that we saw in digital health. And actually is everything that you just talked about. One, people need to make healthy choices and they need to help navigate what those are. So we actually launched something called the Digital Health Advisor. We partnered with a company called WebMD. And we thought, oh, well, will someone actually use this? And we found, okay, well, people like the idea, but how do we actually get mass adoption? So we said, we have this balanced rewards program. I don't know if anyone knows Walgreens has a balanced rewards program, but we have 110 million Americans in that program. That's the largest loyalty program in the world. The difference is we get points out for buying stuff, right? And so a very small group, got together about 12 months ago and said, what if we actually gave points out for healthy behaviors? What if we gave points to people, which is real cash, 1,000 points equals a dollar, for walking, for setting goals, for managing their diabetes, for managing their heart disease, uploading these things using biometrics and using wearables. And then what if we did that and did it at scale? And we did. And it became the first loyalty program that actually rewarded healthy behaviors. Has over 800,000 customers in the last 12 months, I think, engaged in this thing, and over 450,000 connected wearables in the program. So Fitbits, Misfits, all of those, they're all connected, and people are getting points and Apple Watch for using these things every single day. And what did we find out? We did a study. 72% of our consumers connected with a wearable stayed connected with that wearable past 12 months. Now, for anyone that kind of looks at that, that's actually a big feat, because most people take this thing off, they put it on the nightstand after about month three, and then it kind of just goes away. It works itself out somewhere. Whereas now we see that around 70 to 72% of our users stay connected past 12 months with a wearable. And we think, and it's an assumption, we don't know everything yet, but we think it has something to do with getting rewards every single day for using it.
I care it.
The rewards and benefits is touching on a point I think you mentioned earlier, which was behavioral scientists. One of the most important things in my experience too, when it comes to health, is that people are not rational. There's no logic. And there's a lot of books that have been written about it. Dan Ariely has written a couple of books on the irrationality when it comes to health. And you'll end up finding that one of the basic premises were, if you short-term pains will overrule long-term gains. So even if you can really benefit by detecting a disease early or lowering the risk for a disease, a very small short-term pain, most people will end up not taking or not wearing or not using the technology. And it's been fascinating to see how very small things, just like what Adam mentioned in terms of very small rewards, almost completely insignificant. And you're saying, you know, what is it? 1,000 points here is $1? Yeah. It's like, okay, we gave them $3 over half a year, but that was enough to get you to do something. It's exactly like a cup of coffee. But people are not logical when it comes to their health and decision-making. And that's why understanding it and thinking through it and the gamification behind it is critical for some of the success of those different applications or devices.
Well, and I have to say, this is a very common approach to that. You know, has anyone gone to a gaming, like an arcade, and gotten those tickets, or had your child get those tickets? I will tell you, I have literally spent probably $300 on stuffed animals and lava lamps. And the thing is because those tickets, you get an armful of them, but they really, you know, there's could be 10,000 tickets and you buy a lava lamp. And yet that doesn't become what the intrinsic value, or the extrinsic value of those tickets, right? It's the fact that I got 10,000 tickets and now I can get this lava lamp. And yet you can't buy that lava lamp if you ask to pay in cash. You know, that's really interesting. But I have a lot of lava lamps. But I would say is it motivates them to play those games over and over again. So we find the same thing where you may only, you know, we give 250 points for connecting a Fitbit or a wearable to our platform, right? That's 250 points. 1,000 points equals a dollar. So do the math. It's not like a lot of money, but it's 250 points, you know? And so I think some of those things help drive the adoption. And it goes back to the hype conversation, right? If we could start seeing tangible results around outcomes and adoption of some of these basic simple things, I think more people will focus on removing the friction from simple tasks. You know, interoperability is another important one that I'm super passionate. I was part of a product called Microsoft Health Vault. I will say it was, some people will say it was ahead of its time. That's being incredibly polite. It was a very ahead of its time product. But consumers didn't want to log in on Saturday morning necessarily and update their PHR. They wanted data pulled together for them, and they wanted it delivered to them, right? So I think you're seeing some of these technologies that are really new, maybe have lots of excitement behind them 3 or 4 years ago. They're not going away, but they're just evolving into something that's a little bit more user-friendly.
One thing I'd like to step back a little bit to is because I think we're talking a little bit in the abstract about what digital health is. And Ram, I'd love to get your talk a little bit about some of the work that you've done. I've heard you speak in the past where you talk about what some of these sensors that can be put on wearable devices and sort of the information that it's able to collect. But not just that, what can be done with that information in the long term. So can you maybe give people a little bit of a vision for what kind of digital health can look like?
So not say no, but look 10 years into the future.
I leave it in your hands.
All right. So some of the stuff I've been working on, which is why I kind of took the privilege of saying how you compare it to what I see today, is some of the most fascinating, amazing technologies that you can have. The initiative I was doing within Samsung built pretty much the most advanced research platform for health sensors. We created a watch that's able to do your ECG, blood pressure tracking, continuously throughout the day, track bit by bit by bit your heart rate, that ended up being translating into understanding things like your heart rate variability, which gives us a hint about your mood and stress levels. And if you took a deeper look into this data, you can understand irregularities in a heart beating, and that might lead into AFib or arrhythmia early stage detection. And understanding, again, by looking at the beats and comparing the electrical signals from an ECG to the optical signals from a PPG, we are able to tell you your blood pressure. And if we are able to tell you your blood pressure and your own blood pressure medication, we can tell you if you didn't take your medication, which is one of the biggest problems. Or we are able to tell you, hey, you just got released from the hospital, and we are noticing here that your blood pressure is really up. Or if a pregnant woman is wearing it, and we are suddenly seeing that she's in her 8 months and suddenly blood pressure is going up, that's a pretty good reason to go to the hospital. And the potential of those technologies and what we can do non-invasively on the body is just absolutely amazing. 10 years into the future, we will all be wearing, whether it's a band or a watch or something in our shirt, that is able to listen to the signals from the body. We used to call it voice of the body, and really interpret it and understand it, and give us really good warnings, not just about the data based on ourselves, but tie it back to the cloud, compare it to other people, and go and say, you know, you're in a risk factor in here. or, you know, by starting to walk every day, you have lowered your risk of diabetes by 5%. The potential of the technologies is amazing, but we need to start it one step at a time, and we need to start it, as you both have pointed out, with simple things that have compelling user experience and user value. Experience and value.
Please jump in here. I know this is an area of focus at UCSF, and so I'd love to get your input.
Oh, thank you. We do have the Center for Digital Health Innovation that's been for 2 years now with four pillars, which is innovation, evaluation, integration, and education. So one of the things I'd like to point out, though, is that I think the definition is very broad now. So we think it's all the way from big data and analytics all the way to nanosensors and everything, hardware, software in between. It's also now in the cloud, so it's hardware, software, everywhere and nowhere, basically. But we do think that it's much bigger than just the wearables or the consumer-facing apps. We leverage digital health to get to something. So we're working very hard on getting to precision medicine so that we can combine genomics, phenomics, now the microbiome, even your consumer analytics now, and create new relationships we've never understood that help us know more about you as an individual and what your risks are and what your treatment could be that would optimize your outcome. We're also looking at that in terms of population, so not just the individual. The other big emphasis I want to make, besides this allowing precision medicine to actually be realized, is we have another concept called informed health. And I think this gets to several things that we've talked about earlier. What is meaningful to someone? So, for instance, we lead informed lives. And if anyone has a phone in their hand and you're thinking of going to dinner tonight, you might have pushed in an open table, for instance. But the point is you get pertinent data pushed to you at the moment of decision making that optimizes your decision. And it's something I now call point of choice instead of point of care, because many of us are making choices besides just the doctor. So I think that the better we get at contextualizing data and pushing the pertinent information up to the moment of decision making or the point of choice, the more we're going to get to what I call informed health, like we lead informed lives. And I think that the end point is more important than the actual tool. So what is digital health? Digital health is a broad spectrum now of technologies that are in a digital format. Ultimately, we're probably just going to call it health because it'll just be the medium that we work in. But we're really interested in what it enables us to do and how we can transform healthcare with that. So moving from symptom-based to actual specific person-based and individualized treatment-based is really important. The other thing I would say is that I think that we have many influences on us now that are driving the need for us to find new tools. So we're very excited about the capabilities in the digital world. And the influences are moving in healthcare from value to volume-based, from provider-centered to patient-centered and patient-empowered care. And as you know, we're moving more into aggregating systems and ACOs. So there are mandates for collaboration and shared risk and responsibility, but the technologies haven't quite kept up yet. I actually think the biggest thing we're doing now is moving care outside the building. And the technologies that allow us to support people in their life flow, targeted specifically to what their needs are in their lives and their preferences, I think that's where we're going to see a lot more of the power of these tools, especially the ones that you're both working on.
And I'll just add on to that. I mean, we have the power, all of us most likely in this room have been on Facebook within at least once in the last 3 days. I'm just guessing, or a large percentage. We have the power to automatically tag photos and where everybody was together in one event, even though we didn't collaborate on those photos, yet we don't have the ability to reconcile medication lists from multiple different systems that are actually the same systems when someone gets admitted into an emergency room, like my grandfather the other day, and expect that nurse is going to pile through 50 pages of medication data from three different systems that are actually the same system but not connected, and then expect that consumer or that patient is going to be able to tell the nurse, and she's going to have the time to say, this is what all the meds I've been on. We could do all this fancy stuff with Facebook and social networking and all this other stuff. Why can't we do the same thing for basic life-saving things like that? I think that's the work you're working on and the stuff that I'm specifically passionate about.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Ram Fish, founder and CEO of 19 Labs, Adam Pellegrini, Vice President of Digital Health at Walgreens, and Einar Sawyer, Associate Director of Strategic Relations at the Center for Digital Health Innovation at UC San Francisco. This conversation is being moderated by Adam Satriano, technology reporter at Bloomberg News. This program was recorded live in San Francisco as part of our annual conference. The World Affairs Council is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org.
I'm just going to jump in on that because I think it's so important to understand that the medication journey has so many gaps in it, in interoperability of data. And, you know, not to use the term crassly, but supply chain is sometimes applied to the whole pharmaceutical industry. The gaps in it result in $300 billion of waste per year, let alone devastating outcomes for people. So if we can start connecting the dots better in the medication journey, all the way back from discovery, development, clinical trial innovation, all the way across, I'm an orthopedist and run the skeletal health service. When I order a medication, I don't actually know if it's been filled. And if it's been filled, I don't know if the patient's taking it. If they're taking it, I don't know what their experience with it is. There's some wonderful things happening where we're partnering with the pharmacies, getting information into the EHR. It got filled. We're also with Iodine, which is a startup that's working on the patient experience side of medication. We're getting better, but all of that journey needs to be connected. And it's exciting, the steps that are being taken, and I think we have the ability to string a lot of those pearls together and make less human impact that's really negative and also save quite a bit of money.
One point that was mentioned was, I think, the challenges of trying to make things more efficient within an existing system like the hospital. And as an entrepreneur, you always try to think, well, the place where you have the least friction. And the biggest potential that we have for adoption of the new technologies and the new solutions is really outside of the hospital walls. Solutions that help you use and utilize things within your home, get more services within your home, are some of the biggest opportunities here. They are less regulated. There are less existing players with different incentives or systems or contracts. And from an opportunity perspective, there are so many different things that can be done around services, around the home, that I think that's one of the biggest opportunities in front of us for digital health.
There's a topic that a few questions have come in about, and it's an important one, is the issues around accessibility. The access to healthcare in our country, I think, is pretty well established that the healthcare system works very well for a lot of people and not very well for a lot of people. Will the advances here that we're talking about, are they just going to exacerbate this divide, and sort of what policies can be put in place so that is not the case?
So I'll start on that, if that's all right with you.
Please.
I think it's very important. First of all, we care for vulnerable populations as well as global populations at UCSF. And I think we see capacity to narrow the divide. I think this ability to empower people. And, you know, the cell phone penetration is astounding across the world. It may not all be smartphones, but we have tremendous ability just in SMS platforms to communicate with people. And we have many mobile interventions that are happening in that medium alone. And also leveraging existing infrastructure like the community health workers, et cetera. So I don't see it as widening the gap. I see it as narrowing it. I think if we do it well, we show effectiveness in care and cost, we should be delivering on the triple aims, which is better care to more people at lower cost. We have many specific examples of how that's starting to play out. We need more examples of that, and we also need the ability to sustain that over time.
I think you nailed it. And I would say this is an interesting thing as well. Not a lot of people know that you can actually, there's a Walgreens right down the street. I'm not promoting. I'm just giving this an example. There's many other pharmacies around there too. But did anyone know that you can just walk up to a pharmacy counter, talk to a pharmacist about a health question, without getting a prescription or even shopping there, right? And that's an interesting concept. That's basically free health information from a healthcare professional who went to an advanced school and received an advanced degree. Now, that's been happening since well before Walgreens, but I can actually speak to the fact that it's been happening since 1901 from Walgreens. So digital health aspect of that, what we thought was, well, if you're going to be able to talk to a pharmacist anyways, why wouldn't we use something like chat? And so we implemented pharmacy chat, where we actually have 15 licensed pharmacists that chat with our with not just our customers, with anyone via the mobile phone or tablet, I'm pointing to a tablet, or desktop. We do 8 to 10,000 chats a week for free, regardless if they're our customers or not. And those chats can come from anything from, I have no idea what this is, to, will this be an interaction? So we know that there's value in leveraging existing professionals that are already giving healthcare advice at no cost to anyone. And then when you look at actually delivering care, partnering with the local provider, using things like telemedicine, right? I mean, the fact that there are, you know, and here's another one where there's a lot of hype, to be completely honest, around telemedicine right now. But there's some pretty basic use cases that it can actually solve. If I wanted to have a consultation that's informational consultation with a doctor, and it's a local doctor, do I need to wait 6 weeks and take up somebody else's spot who needs to take their kid in? Or can I have that consultation via video? That's a pretty logical use case and use of that technology. And what it does is it democratizes the access of that technology, because now you're spanning, our telemedicine uses local doctors for local health systems, but you're not now bound by within 3 blocks of a hospital or within 6 blocks of a hospital. It could be within a zip code. So you actually do sort of load balance the providers by using technology. Where that will go, we shall see. Mm-hmm. We're in pilot mode with that. But I think we will see the fact that chatting with a doctor, asynchronous care with a doctor, those type of things, it has some pretty simple and logical use cases.
How does digital technology and things like telemedicine, and how are these going to change the relationship that people have with their doctors? It's obviously a very important relationship that someone has. It's a very personal relationship. Is it, as more technology is added to the equation, does that sort of relationship fracture? Does it become more distant? Or are there other things at play?
I'm on the telehealth task force for UCY at UCOP and also at UCSF, and left a phone call to join the stage here just now. But what I wanted to say to that is we have a lot of efforts going on that. We've had telederm at our university for a long, long time, and so patients who couldn't make appointments and put them off, we were able to pick up on lesions and give responses and able to triage much earlier when those lesions could have gone on to be quite devastating. So I think the ability for people to access care is going to get greater and greater with these extending tools. So to answer your question, I think what people want is a relationship. They want response. They want reassurance as real time as possible. And these tools enable that. And I think people are much more used to not having to be physically in the same space to feel reassured by someone and get information back. So the more real time we can give the information and the more precise to that person's needs, the better. So I don't see it as fracturing the relationship. I actually think it's enhancing it, because people are getting responses that they need much sooner. We're also able to reach people who can't come to us. And we do have a creative, you know, we have a house calls program at UCSF, which people might not know, but we also have a lot of telehealth and remote care platforms that we leverage. So people who don't physically have an easy way to get in and get clinical care are getting services that they've never had before. And whether it's in a video platform or a purely digital asynchronous platform, I think we're actually improving the relationships.
It's a good segue, because the question here is whether or not things like this, though, will lower trust and empathy, which can be critical when making decisions about care.
I will have to say telemedicine to me, and I'll put it in specific context, because what telemedicine we do is video telemedicine. But we do chat, and some people would say chat with a pharmacist could be as well. It depends on your classification. But I've started using this really interesting tool, I don't know if anyone else uses it, called FaceTime. And some people use a tool called Skype. And especially if you travel a lot, it seems to be a really great way of talking to your family. And I can have some pretty meaningful conversations with my family that are empathetic in nature or fun in nature via FaceTime or Skype. The question is, the new generations come on that frankly, I will say I've been talking about telemedicine now for 2.5 years. And every conference I speak at, I first start it with who uses FaceTime, raise your hand. I'm not doing any more raise the hand, promise.
It's radio.
Yeah. Everyone's raising their hand. I used to do it almost, very little people did about 2.5 years ago. Now I can almost get 80 to 90% of the people will raise their hand saying they've used FaceTime or Skype. I think as our behaviors and adoption around technology like that changes, I think even the providers may see this as a way to conveniently have meaningful conversations with consumers. And remember, nurse lines have been around for a long time without mm-hmm. video, right? So you're just talking about an evolution of a new technology enhancing that experience.
We're also able to push higher levels of care outside the building by putting video.
And by outside the building, you mean?
I mean outside of the brick and mortar. Yeah, right. The clinical setting. So into the ambulance or into the home where someone's having a crisis. So what I mean by that is we're now able to have experts sitting back at a base station and actually visualizing the neuro exam of a patient who might be in an evolving stroke and be able to triage which hospital they go to depending on what their needs are based on that exam. So instead of that person having to come all the way in, may or may not, time is so lost in all of that when decision-making could start earlier because we're pushing the expertise out to where the person is based on these tools.
We're talking a lot about what the positive impact of what digital health is. What are some of the potential drawbacks, ramifications? What's some of the negative? It can't all be rainbows and improvements. Ram, why don't you jump in?
I'll tell you a personal story. California came up with this new rule that says, we are going to lead the nation and do DNA testing using the latest technology for every newborn. A wonderful idea, great intentions. And when my second daughter was born, about a month after the birth, we went to do the regular checkup. We sit down with the doctor and she says, with this grim face, I need to let you know that your daughter has CF. And we were pretty shocked, like every parent would be. And for the next half a year, we went through a whole learning of the fact that there can be different mutations that science have not discovered yet what they mean, but they can be completely normal. So my daughter does not have any symptoms of CF, but this test have showed some mutation that was just not known before. And this is an example of the extreme of how lots of new information can get us suspect or be aware of problems that might not actually be real problems. On the most basic things, as we get more information about family around us and ourselves, that helps us be maybe a bit more worried. And there is a reason why how this information, medical information, is displayed and presented as something that the FDA is actually looking at very carefully. Because very quickly, by exposing and giving more information around health to consumers, we can cause skyrocketing number of calls to doctors and healthcare professionals. So how do we balance this? How do we take this whole new slew of data, which might have a meaning or might not have a meaning, and turn it into information? And I'm making here a very clear distinction between data and information. Information is something valuable that a doctor can act on. And taking the huge amounts of data that are being collected by all of the different gizmos or new tests and turning them into information is one of the pitfalls, I think, that we have to watch out for.
Yeah, and I will use a prop to explain mine. So my healthcare journey as a professional, healthcare professional clinically, the first 10 years of my career, was not digital at all. And it was actually the most opposite of digital. I was a combat medic in the military, in the U.S. Army. And one thing I constantly say is the only thing this would have been good for is potentially a sucking chest wound, right? Because you could maybe put it there and stop something. But that's about it, right? Digital is not going to cure everything. There's literally not an app for that, right? There's not going to be an app for a sucking chest wound. So I think one thing we have been incredibly, I think we've been very self-aware of at Walgreens, specifically in digital health, is that it requires an omni-channel approach, meaning you are not going to replace the pharmacist just because you can chat with the pharmacist. You do a refill by scan picture. The prescription's not going to, we're not in the matrix. It's not going to mystically appear in front of our hands and then we're going to take our, you need to go in to see the pharmacist. You have to talk to the pharmacist. If we're going to launch a diabetes coaching program, wouldn't it be great if there's also a human involved in that process at the pharmacy counter that can actually talk to you about options as well as a digital thing? So there, we do run the risk, and we as a digital health industry, a movement or whatever you want to call it, run the risk of thinking digital will fix everything and that you can create an app for everything. It took me a while because I'm so passionate about digital health, but it's just the truth, right? An app is an app, and it can do some apps can do some cool things, but nothing is going to replace that provider, that doctor interaction. What you want to do is enhance it, evolve it, and extend it. And that's the terms I use.
Another issue that I think is and want to hear some perspective on is regarding privacy. And with all this information that is being generated, or data that's being generated, I think there's will be some justifiable worry about how that information can be used by an insurance company or your employer. Will some data be interpreted by an insurance company as an excuse to increase your rates, or information that can be shared with your employer somehow? And I think people have some very genuine and justifiable concerns about how this data can be protected, and that it's theirs, and that it isn't used against them in some ways. What are some ways in which this is being considered in the field?
Well, I think from our standpoint, we consider privacy and security around patient information incredibly important. It's one of our responsibilities, and we do get criticized at times for not releasing data to a lot of the tech startups who want the data, and it's really important. It's our responsibility, and I think each of us as individuals, we want still to make choices around that information. One of the dilemmas we have is the pace of technology has outstripped societal consensus around issues of privacy and security, and it's also sometimes generational as to who really wants that or not. We still have a duty, I think, on the medical side to protect it. It's the patient's choice. They actually own the data, which is also another thing that needs to get sorted out. But it's their choice who they share it with. Now, data can be shared in great meaning, extracted from it in de-identified and aggregated forms of data sets. So I think there's a real power to that. But we do need to catch up a little bit policy-wise around how data is leveraged. I would say the other thing that's tricky right now is we used to have a very clear line of where PHI, or protected health information, starts and stops. We don't anymore. There's data coming in from outside the clinical system, from inside the clinical system, moving out and back and forth. So it's no longer a line of when it's PHI and when it's not. So I think the best measure right now, because I think we have the capacity now with some of our larger partners in technology, is to move the security and privacy technology measures further and further out, so that no matter if the patient sends me something from their app, It can be secure all the way in and out. So I think that's one of the technology steps we can take. I also think that it's hard for patients because I think some of the fears are real, and we don't know how people are going to use the information. And there will be more and more cases. And I don't necessarily think the biggest risk is from the intentional or malicious use of it or discriminatory use. That's a concern, but I think it's actually the data being mined by people that we actually, who might not be as good-hearted. So that's, we've seen that happening over and over now.
I was just going to have Ram jump in here. What do you think the role of the FDA is here and government regulators to oversee this type of area? Typically, they try and restrict their oversight to what's considered a medical device. And when I've spoken with them about this issue, there's been a little bit of reluctance to get too involved. But what role can a federal government agency play in sort of setting the rules of the road?
It's an excellent question, and it's a difficult one. Government can really mess things up by trying to overregulate. At the same time, we're talking here about your health. And I was sitting with a fellow entrepreneur who was developing some device that was able to display ECG. And he was complaining about the fact that the FDA told him, you can't just go and show ECG to the consumer. If you want to show him their ECG graph, that becomes an FDA approval. And went, why the hell are they doing it this way? Like, why are they regulating this for me? And I looked at him, because when you have an ECG chart and you look at it and you're talking to your friend who's a doctor and this device is showing you noise with all kind of spikes, well, it's actually a manufacturer fault in how they designed it, you will run to the doctor and the doctor will have a wrong diagnosis. So there is an important role that the FDA is playing. And my experience with the FDA has actually been fantastically positive. Thoughtful, not trying to overregulate, trying to think through together with the industry and the startups on what is the right approach. And these are new territories that we are dealing with right now. Just earlier this week in my startup, I dropped a line to the guy who's leading digital health in the FDA and told him, I need to tell you about some of the stuff I'm working on, even though it's really early on. I think you should understand it. He called me the next day. We were sitting and talking, and it was, I'm so glad you're talking to us early because you're raising here some new issues that we have not thought through. And to some extent, I was more on the side of, I think the FDA need to think through on how to regulate it. And he was more thinking through, how can I not regulate it? which is very not typical approach. But we landed up on, you should come over and we will bring the right experts in the room and try to find out the right approach for those new problems that they're facing.
What was the questions that sparked the sort of murky area that needed to be worked out?
A lot of those new technologies that we are seeing right now are raising things that it's not clear. Are you presenting instructions? Are you presenting the correct instructions to the user? Is the information that you are displaying clinical, or is it pure fitness? Where do you draw the line? Where is the point in which you say, if you're displaying this to the user, you can cause the number of calls to the doctor to triple because you're displaying the wrong information. So just like we as entrepreneurs and technologists are trying to face those problems, the FDA is trying to do the right thing in here. And my advice to anybody else in this space is, don't look at the FDA as an enemy or horrible government entity. Try to find a good way of working with them. Always, when you think about those devices and application and services, try to imagine yourself as the user who's suddenly being displayed with a photo of their inside ear or a report about their DNA or and problems, or a ECG graph and heart rate variability or missed beats, how will you react as a consumer? What will be your expectations from the company who provided you this information? And as you think through those issues, talking to the FDA as an executive in a company can really help you, I think, make the right decisions.
We're getting close to the end, but I wanted to maybe close with a broader question to leave people with. But Einar, could you talk a little bit about where you see a digital health going over the next 5-10 years, and will it have a meaningful impact in bringing down healthcare costs?
Yes, absolutely. I think it can if done right. So back to the same points I made earlier, I think it's going to help us in the big transitions in healthcare that we talked about, but also move us more towards precision medicine and the informed health mode. But again, as you said earlier, what are the risks in all of this? And those are what we need to manage and be realistic about. And I think one of them is we can't oversimplify the problems. And oftentimes you see technologies come out with very big claims. And I think sometimes the conditions are trying to be too simplified, that an EKG lead that you can actually wear under your watch, you want to make sure, is that a 1 lead, a 3 lead? What is it actually able to predict? Do we have observational analytics or predictive and prescriptive? So we have to maintain the scientific rigor about it. So we shouldn't oversimplify. We also need to do a much better job defining where's the boundary between high tech and high touch. There will always be a need for high touch in healthcare. And so we need to figure out where those boundaries are. That'll help us with the cost management piece. Definitely being able to do risk prediction from data analytics will help us allocate resources better and manage people earlier who need more help up front. And I think we need to be very careful that we help people contextualize the information that they now have access to, because I think that's a big problem. Just on the regulatory piece for 1 second, I think there is a valuable role. And I think what people might not be thinking of is that a lot of the sensors you're wearing, there's a blur now between wellness, illness. We go back and forth on that spectrum many times in our lives. But if you're wearing a device now that you're counting on for your heart rate, now we're getting more to wearable blood pressures, can you really count on it? Is it really giving you the right information? Many of the consumer devices haven't been well validated. Many have drift over time. So you want to make sure as you're moving from a well fitness person, perhaps into an illness state, that you can count on that device, that you're not getting a false sense of security. And if it's actually directing an action you should take that could have a risk in health, you do want some oversight on that. So I fully agree with Ram, and I really was happy to hear his perspective. We need to understand what something's telling us and make sure that it's something we can really count on. And I think there are some oversight bodies that play a role in that. Yes, I definitely think that going forward, this is going to facilitate better care for more people and at lower cost.
We've covered a lot of ground today, and I really appreciate the time that you've taken. We've talked about everything from lava lamps to how digital sensors can help.
Back to the Future, that's typically what I'm an expert in.
But I really appreciate your time. This is a very important topic. When you see a lot of startups now who are making sort of little GIF applications or something like that, it's nice to see people who are focused on problems like health. So thank you for your time, and thanks to the World Affairs Council for holding this event.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. World Affairs is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Featured in this program are Ram Fish of 19 Labs, Adam Pellegrini of Walgreens, and Einar Sawyer of the Center for Digital Health Innovation at UC San Francisco. This conversation was moderated by Adam Satriano, technology reporter at Bloomberg News. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.